And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Election year 2008. Less than 11 months until we will have decided who will lead this nation. My prediction? Be prepared for some surprises. This thing is not over yet. Today we hear from the legendary Jane Goodall about what distinguishes us from our closest relatives, and we examine some of the challenges and opportunities facing us as we begin forging a new energy and sustainable economy. And the American miracle? That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Mid-January and much of the nation is in the deep freeze. And that's tough because it costs a lot to keep the pipes from freezing when it's 15 below zero. About the same time, Congress and the President have finally agreed on something. And this is, something is needed to stimulate the economy. An economy that is being held responsible for a significant decline in markets around the world, which may result in a similar reaction here in America as the markets open today. What's all this have to do with nature and the environment? I think it could provide the incentive to launch the real re-energizing of America, and I'll cover that following the Weekly Earth Summit, which will feature an address by Jane Goodall, the woman who redefined the definition of man. We'll hear from Ms. Goodall in just a moment. In segment two, we hear from Emil Pena, who served with Bill Richardson in the Energy Department, about the prospects and processes needed that could help change the energy equation, and about his newest endeavor, turning research and inventiveness at Rice University in Houston, Texas, into viable businesses that go way beyond solar and wind. But now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith. Today's summit features one of the most honored and important people of our era, the woman who helped redefine man, Jane Goodall, who will enlighten us on what separates us from apes. So now, Jane Goodall.
I came directly here from the deep, deep tropical rainforest in Ecuador, where I was out, you could only get there by a plane, with indigenous people with paint on their faces and parrot feathers on their headdresses, where these people are fighting to try and keep the oil companies and keep the roads out of their forests. They're fighting to develop their own way of living within the forest in a world that's clean, a world that isn't contaminated, a world that isn't polluted. There, right in the middle of this rainforest, was some solar panels, the first in that part of Ecuador, and that was mainly to bring water up by pump so that the women wouldn't have to go down. The water was cleaned, but because they got a lot of batteries, they were able to store a lot of electricity, so every house, and there were I think 8 houses in this little community, could have light for I think it was about half an hour each evening. And there is the chief in all his regal finery with a laptop computer. And this man, he has been outside, but he's gone back. And he was saying, you know, we have suddenly jumped into a whole new era. And we didn't even know about the white man 50 years ago. Now here we are with laptop computers, and there are some things we want to learn from the modern world. We want to know about health care. We want to know about what other people do. We're interested in it. And we want to learn other languages. We want to know English and French and perhaps Chinese, and we're good at languages. So there he is with his little laptop computer, but fighting against the might of the pressures because of the debt, the foreign debt of Ecuador, fighting the pressure of World Bank, IMF, and of course the people who want to exploit the forests and take out the oil. So coming directly from there to here, but of course my real field of expertise lies in an even different kind of civilization. I can't really call it a civilization, a different way of life from a different being. And I propose to bring into this TED conference, as I always do around the world, the voice of the animal kingdom. Too often we just see a few slides or a bit of film, but these beings have voices that mean something. And so I want to give you a greeting as from a chimpanzee in the forest of Tanzania. I've been studying chimpanzees in Tanzania since 1960. During that time, there have been modern technologies that have really transformed the way that field biologists do their work. For example, for the first time a few years ago, by simply collecting little fecal samples, we were able to have them analyzed, to have DNA profiling done. So for the first time, we actually know which male chimps are the fathers of each individual infant, because the chimps have a very promiscuous mating society. So this opens up a whole new avenue of research. And we use GSI to determine the range of the chimps, and we're using you can see that I'm not really into this kind of stuff, but we're using satellite imagery to look at the deforestation in the area. And of course there's developments in infrared, so you can watch animals at night, and equipment for recording by video and tape recording is getting lighter and better. So in many, many ways, we can do things today that we couldn't do when I began in 1960. Especially when chimpanzees and other animals with large brains are studied in captivity, modern technology is helping us to search for the upper levels of cognition in some of these non-human animals, so that we know today they're capable of performances that would have been thought absolutely impossible by science when I began. I think the chimpanzee in captivity who is the most skilled in intellectual performance is one called Ai in Japan. Her name means love, and she has a wonderfully sensitive partner working with her. She loves her computer. She'll leave her big group and her running water and her trees and everything, and she'll come in to sit at this computer. It's like a video game for a kid. She's hooked. She's 28, by the way. And she does things with her computer screen with a touchpad that she can do faster than most humans. She does very complex tasks, and I haven't got time to go into them. But the amazing thing about this female is she doesn't like making mistakes. If she has a bad run and her score isn't good, she'll come and reach up and tap on the glass because she can't see the experimenter, which is asking to have another go. And her concentration, she's already concentrated hard for 20 minutes or so, and now she wants to do it all over again just for the satisfaction of having done it better. And the food is not important. She does get a tiny reward, like one raisin, for a correct response, but she will do it for nothing if you tell her beforehand. So, you know, so here we are, a chimpanzee using a computer. Chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans also learn human sign language. But the point is that when I was first in Gombe in 1960, I remember so well, so vividly, as though it was yesterday, the first time when I was going through the vegetation, the chimpanzees were still running away from me for the most part, although some were a little bit acclimatized. And I saw this dark shape hunched over a termite mound. I peered with my binoculars. It was fortunately one adult male whom I'd named David Greybeard. And by the way, science at that time was telling me that I shouldn't name the chimps. They should all have numbers. That was more scientific. Anyway, David Greybeard. And I saw that he was picking little pieces of grass and using them to fish termites from their underground nest. And not only that, he would sometimes pick a leafy twig and strip the leaves, modifying an object to make it suitable for a specific purpose, the beginning of tool making. The reason this was so exciting and such a breakthrough is at that time, it was thought that humans and only humans used and made tools. When I was at school, we were defined as man, the toolmaker. So that when Louis Leakey, my mentor, heard this news, he said, we must now redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans. We now know that at Gombe alone, there are 9 different ways in which chimpanzees use different objects for different purposes. Moreover, we know that in different parts of Africa, wherever chimps have been studied, there are completely different tool-using behaviors. And because it seems that these patterns are passed from one generation to the next through observation, imitation, and practice, that is a definition of human culture. What we find is that over these 40-odd years that I and others have been studying chimpanzees and the other great apes, and as I say, other mammals with complex brains and social systems, we have found that after all, there isn't a sharp line dividing humans from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's a very wuzzy line. It's getting wuzzier all the time as we find animals doing things that we, in our arrogance, used to think was just human. The chimps, there's no time to discuss their fascinating lives, but they have this long childhood, 5 years of suckling and sleeping with the mother, and then another 3, 4, or 5 years of emotional dependence on her even when the next child is born. The importance of learning in that time when behavior is flexible and there's an awful lot to learn in chimpanzee society. The long-term affectionate supportive bonds that develop throughout this long childhood with the mother, with the brothers and sisters, and which can last through a lifetime which may be up to 60 years. They can actually live longer than 60 in captivity. So we've only done 40 years in the wild so far. And we find chimps are capable of true compassion and altruism. We find in their non-verbal communication, this is very rich, they have a lot of sounds which they use in different circumstances, but they also use touch, posture, gesture. And what do? They kiss, they embrace, they hold hands, they pat one another on the back, they swagger, they shake their fist. The kind of things that we do, and they do them in the same kind of context. They have very sophisticated cooperation. Sometimes they hunt, not that often, but when they hunt, they show sophisticated cooperation, and they share the prey. We find that they show emotions similar to, maybe sometimes the same, as those that we describe in ourselves as happiness, sadness, fear, despair. They know mental as well as physical suffering, and I don't have time to go into the information that would prove some of these things to you, save to say that there are very bright students in the best universities studying emotions in animals, studying personalities in animals. We know that chimpanzees and some other creatures can recognize themselves in mirrors, self as opposed to other. They have a sense of humor. And these are the kind of things which traditionally have been thought of as human prerogatives. But this teaches us a new respect, and it's a new respect not only for the chimpanzees, I suggest, but some of the other amazing animals with whom we share this planet. Once we're prepared to admit that after all, we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and above all, feelings. And then we start to think about ways we use and abuse so many other sapient creatures on this planet. It really gives cause for deep shame, at least for me. So, the sad thing is that these chimpanzees, who perhaps taught us more than any other creature, a little humility, are in the wild disappearing very fast. They're disappearing for the reasons that all of you in this room know only too well: the deforestation, the growth of human populations needing more land. They're disappearing because some timber companies go in with clear cutting. They're disappearing in the heart of their range in Africa because the big multinational logging companies have come in and made roads, as they want to do in Ecuador and other parts where the forests remain untouched, to take out oil or timber. And this has led in Congo Basin and other parts of the world to what's known as the bushmeat trade. This means that although for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, people have lived in those forests or whatever habitat it is in harmony with their world, just killing the animals they need for themselves and their families, now suddenly, because of the roads, the hunters can go in from the towns. They shoot everything, every single thing that moves that's bigger than a small rat. They sun-dry it or smoke it. Now they've got transport. They take it on the logging trucks or the mining trucks into the towns where they sell it. And people will pay more for bushmeat, as it's called, than for domestic meat. It's culturally preferred. And it's not sustainable. And the huge logging camps in the forest are now demanding meat. So the pygmy hunters in the Congo Basin who've lived there with their wonderful way of living for so many hundreds of years are now corrupted. They're given weapons. They shoot for the logging camps. They get money. Their culture is being destroyed, along with the animals upon whom they depend. So when the logging camp moves, there's nothing left. We talked already about the loss of human cultural diversity, and I've seen it happening with my own eyes. And the grim picture in Africa, I love Africa. And what do we see in Africa? We see deforestation. We see the desert spreading. We see massive hunger. We see disease. We see population growth in areas where there are more people living on a certain piece of land than the land can possibly support, and they're too poor to buy food from elsewhere. Where the people that we heard about yesterday on the Easter Island who cut down their last tree, were they stupid? Didn't they know what was happening? Of course, but if you've seen the crippling poverty in some of these parts of the world, it isn't a question of, let's leave the tree for tomorrow. How am I going to feed my family today? Maybe I can get just a few dollars from this last tree, which will keep us going a little bit longer, and then we'll pray that something will happen to save us from the inevitable end. So this is a pretty grim picture. The one thing we have which makes us so different from chimpanzees or other living creatures is this sophisticated spoken language, a language with which we can tell children about things that aren't here. We can talk about the distant past, plan for the distant future, discuss ideas with each other so that the ideas can grow from the accumulated wisdom of a group. We can do it by talking to each other. We can do it through video. We can do it through the written word. And we are abusing this great power we have to be wise stewards. And we're destroying the world. In the developed world, it's in a way, it's worse. Because we have so much access to knowledge of the stupidity of what we're doing. Do you know, we're bringing little babies into a world where in many places the water is poisoning them. And the air is harming them. And the food that's grown from the contaminated land is poisoning them. And that's not just in the far away developing world. That's everywhere. Do you know we all have about 50 chemicals in our bodies we didn't have about 50 years ago? And so many of these diseases, like asthma and certain kinds of cancers, are on the increase around places where our filthy, toxic waste is dumped. We're harming ourselves around the world, as well as harming the animals, as well as harming nature herself, Mother Nature, that brought us into being. Mother Nature, where I believe we need to spend time where there's trees and flowers and birds for our good psychological development. And yet there are hundreds and hundreds of children in the developed world who never see nature, because they're growing up in concrete, and all they know is virtual reality with no opportunity to go and lie in the sun or in the forest with the dappled sun specks coming down from the canopy above. As I was traveling around the world, you know, I had to leave the forest That's where I love to be. I had to leave these fascinating chimpanzees for my students and field staff to continue studying, because finding they dwindled from about 2 million 100 years ago to about 150,000 now, I knew I had to leave the forest to do what I could to raise awareness around the world. And the more I talked about the chimpanzees' plight, the more I realized the fact that everything's interconnected, and the problems of the developing world so often stem from the greed of the developed world. And everything was joining together and making not sense. Hope lies in sense, you said. It's making a nonsense. How can we do it? Somebody said that yesterday. And as I was traveling around, I kept meeting young people who'd lost hope. They were feeling despair. They were feeling, well, it doesn't matter what we do, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Everything's hopeless. We're always being told so by the media. And then I met some who were angry, an anger that can turn to violence. And we're all familiar with that. And I have three little grandchildren. When some of these students would say to me, high school or university, they'd say, we're angry or we're filled with despair because we feel you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. And I looked in the eyes of my little grandchildren and think how much we've harmed this planet since I was their age. I feel this deep shame. And that's why in 1991 in Tanzania, I started a program that's called Roots and Shoots. There's little brochures all around outside. And if any of you have anything to do with children and care about their future, I beg that you pick up that brochure. And Roots and Shoots is a program for hope. Roots make a firm foundation. Shoots seem tiny, but to reach the sun, they can break through brick walls. See the brick walls as all the problems that we've inflicted on this planet. Then you see it is a message of hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can break through and can make this a better world. And the most important message of Roots and Shoots is that every single individual makes a difference. Every individual has a role to play. Every one of us impacts the world around us every day. And you scientists know that you can't actually, even if you stay in bed all day, you're breathing oxygen and giving out CO2. And probably going to the loo and things like that, you're making a difference in the world. So the Roots and Shoots program involves youth in three kinds of projects. And these are projects to make the world around them a better place. One project to show care and concern for your own human community. One for animals, including domestic animals. And I have to say, I learned everything I know about animal behavior even before I got to Gombe and the chimps from my dog, Rusty, who was my childhood companion. And the third kind of project, something for the local environment. So what the kids do depends, first of all, how old are they? And we go now from preschool right through university. It's going to depend whether they're inner city or rural. It's going to depend if they're wealthy or impoverished. It's going to depend which part, say, of America they're in. We're in every state now, and the problems in Florida are different from the problems in New York. It's going to depend on which country they're in. And we're already in 60 plus countries with about 5,000 active groups. Only there are groups all over the place that I keep hearing about that I've never even heard of because the kids are taking the program and spreading it themselves. Why? Because they're buying into it and they're the ones who get to decide what they're going to do. It isn't something that their parents tell them or their teachers tell them. That's effective. But if they decide themselves, we want to clean this river and put the fish back that used to be there. We want to clear away the toxic soil from this area and have an organic garden. We want to go and spend time with the old people and hear their stories and record their oral histories. We want to go and work in a dog shelter. We want to learn about animals. We want to, you know, it goes on and on. And this is very hopeful for me. As I travel around the world 300 days a year, everywhere there's a group of Roots and Shoots of different ages. Everywhere there are children with shining eyes saying, look at the difference we've made. And now comes the technology into it, because with this new way of communicating electronically, these kids can communicate with each other around the world. And if anyone's interested to help us, we've got so many ideas, but we need help. We need help to create the right kind of system that will help these young people to communicate their excitement, but also, and this is so important, to communicate their despair, to say, we've tried this, and it doesn't work, and what should we do? And then, lo and behold, there's another group answering these kids who may be in America, maybe this is a group in Israel, saying, yeah, you did it a little bit wrong, this is how you should do it. The philosophy is very simple. It's we do not believe in violence. No violence, no bombs, no guns. That's not the way to solve problems. Violence leads to violence, at least in my view. So how do we solve? The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture. Hard work and persistence, don't give up. And love and compassion leading to respect for all life. So basically, Roots and Shoots is beginning to change young people's lives. It's what I'm devoting most of my energy to. But the kids do ask me, and this it won't take more than 2 minutes, I promise. The kids say, Dr. Jane, do you really have hope for the future? You travel, you see all this, these horrible things happening. Firstly, the human brain. I don't need to say anything about that. Now that we know what the problems are around the world, human brains like yours are rising to solve those problems. And we've talked a lot about that. Secondly, the resilience of nature. We can destroy a river and we can bring it back to life. We can see a whole area desolated and it can be brought back to bloom again with time or a little help. And thirdly, we are surrounded by the most amazing people who do things that seem to be absolutely impossible. Nelson Mandela, I take a little piece of limestone from Robben Island Prison where he labored for 27 years and came out with so little bitterness. He could lead his people from the horror of apartheid without a bloodbath. Even after the 11th of September, and I was in New York, and I felt the fear. Nevertheless, there was so much human courage, so much love, and so much compassion. And then as I went around the country after that and felt the fear that was leading to people feeling they couldn't worry about the environment anymore in case they seemed not to be patriotic, and I was trying to encourage them, somebody came up with a little quotation from Mahatma Gandhi, "If you look back through human history, you see that every evil regime has been overcome by good." And just after that, a woman brought me this little bell, and I want to end on this note. She said, if you're talking about hope and peace, ring this. This bell is made from metal from a diffused landmine from the killing fields of Pol Pot, one of the most evil regimes in human history, where people are now beginning to put their lives back together after the regime has crumbled. So, yes, there is hope. And where is the hope? Is it out there with the politicians? It's in our hands. It's in your hands and my hands and those of our children. It's really up to us. We're the ones who can make a difference. If we lead lives where we consciously leave the lightest possible ecological footprints, if we buy the things that are ethical for us to buy and don't buy the things that are not, we can change the world overnight. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane Goodall. Every time I've heard Miss Goodall speak, I want to devote myself even more to saving the sacred nature of the wonder of life, and in particular, those animals which find themselves victims on the edge. We are in the middle of a massive muddle when it comes to so many things these days, as human strategies for survival are lumped under the banner of terrorism, as our earth faces unfettered consumption by a population gone commercial, as a great uncertainty ripples through the dreams of good people around the globe. It is time to speak out get up and make a difference. We are coming to a time when we either do or we don't. If we don't, we are in for a very long journey into uncharted realms. I agree with Miss Goodall. Violence, war, aggression against any of the creatures is killing us. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to meet us all here again next week at the Weekly Earth Summit. And now, a special news commentary. As I'm putting this show together, reports are coming in from around the world that foreign markets are taking a beating, reacting to the fear that the U.S. economy appears to be headed into a recession. The reaction is supported by comments from both sides of the aisle that something must be done, and very, very soon, like within 30 days, to prop up, some call it stimulate, the U.S. economy. The president is proposing a $140 billion economic stimulus plan, which could include a check in the mail for, some say, $500 or so, which we are expected to go out and spend on something, anything, to fire things up. Sounds like a Washington fix to me. Another patch. What is amazing is that this is money that will just be given to us. We won't need to pay it back. Such a deal. But I consider this a phenomenal waste at almost every level. It's sort of like advising someone without a job to go spend a lot of money in the hopes that it will eventually make its way back to him or her with a job because of all the new money in the system. I hate to say it, but I think the system is broken. Time for a serious fix. And here's the good news. Think what $140 billion would do for our country if it were quickly spent on launching energy independence in America. $140 billion is a lot of money. Currently, there is $1 billion allocated for financing alternative energy research and development, and a whopping $20 million is allocated for geothermal. We have, in geothermal alone, enough energy to power the United States for hundreds of years. With a dramatic commitment, as we would if we were in a real war, our nation could be mobilized, beginning right now, to use our existing level of technological sophistication in solar, wind, geothermal, biofuels, hydrogen, distributed systems, nanotechnology, advanced materials, and systems development to construct the manufacturing plants, reconfigure our auto industry, hire and train workers to prepare for the transformation of our society. With a $140 billion gift to the American people that would benefit them and all those to follow and significantly change our hopes, our security, and our dreams. Rather than have each of us take our little $500 and buy a new iPod or laptop or go on a cruise or buy a new countertop, we could unite as a people to take back our future. After all, it is our money. At this time in our history, shouldn't such a massive financial commitment be directed to the exact place that it would do the most good? I'm proposing today that Congress immediately hold emergency sessions to explore what could be done to use that $140 billion in a way that would directly and quickly launch a decade of discovery to a sustainable future. Governors should be involved in the decision-making, identifying available resources within their states which are sitting fallow at this time, which could be quickly transformed into manufacturing centers for residential and business, solar panels, and for appropriate wind systems that could quickly be distributed around the nation, putting people back to work now. Energy-efficient lighting, heating, air conditioning, and appliances of every kind should be manufactured starting right now. People would be employed right now to get the job done as soon as possible, as we would in times of war. Regional training centers should be quickly set up in vacant facilities around the country and in universities and community colleges, and trainers educated and employed to begin the process of re-energizing America. Schools at all levels should become partnered in these efforts. National broadcast systems should be established to provide daily briefings on this emergency energy and economic effort. Could we do this? Yes, of course we could. Should we do this? It sure seems to make more sense than sending out $500 checks. Would the American public welcome this? I'd be willing to bet that they would overwhelmingly respond to this call. We are smart. We know this is something we need right now. Will it happen? We'll know within 60 days. What can you do? Ask people you know what they think about it, and ask them to do the same. Within 60 days, $140 billion will be handed out. Think for just a moment what that could do for you, your friends, your family, your neighbors, your city, your state and nation. This could be the kind of revolution that only America could pull off. History would look back and record this moment as the American miracle. Godspeed and good luck. When we return, we talk with Emil Pena, former Department of Energy official who is now applying his skills and experience into technologies that will change the world.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
In order for America to meet the challenge of a world struggling for resources, oil, and power, our best plan may be to invent our way into energy efficiency. But invention isn't enough. These innovations need to find their place in the new energy mix. In just a moment, we talk with a former Department of Energy official who worked directly under Bill Richardson about what science and business can do when they put their minds together. Stay tuned. Every day, we hear about the prospects of energy independence. We generally talk about wind and solar, geothermal and biofuels and the like as the viable alternatives. But the moment you really look at any of these, you'll find that each of these technologies is a complex assemblage of every kind of more elegant technology. So, where's the innovation coming from? Business plays a large role but so do our universities. Today, we explore what Rice University in Houston, Texas, is doing under the direction of very informed and experienced leadership. Right now, we're talking about adding some economic stimulus to our economy here. $150 billion incentive may be in the mailbox relatively soon because we need it. One of the reasons that we're being forced into this position is because so much of our economy is now focused on supporting the high cost of energy in everything that we do. Sustainability, energy independence is on the table for lots and lots of people. It's something that people are very comfortable talking about. Our politicians are talking about it, actually of both parties. And so in order to accomplish that, it's going to take a lot of new technologies, a lot of people thinking about what can be done, experimenting with that, and bringing it all to market. And someone who's directly involved in virtually all of those arenas is our guest right now, Emil Pena, who is talking to us now from Houston, Texas. He's the new executive director of the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute of Rice University. Mr. Pena, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sid.
You have quite an interesting background. You've been involved with energy issues for quite some time. Why don't you give us a little history of what you've been doing for much of your life?
I'm a native Texan, and I came out of University of Texas. I've been involved in energy my whole professional career. I started out in pipeline, the mid-region here in Texas, in the natural gas pipeline area. And I also worked for Atlantic Richfield for a number of years. That was an integrated oil and gas company, and we really were in everything into refining as well as exploration and production. As of late, in 2000, I served in the Clinton administration under Secretary Bill Richardson in the Energy Department, where I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Oil and Gas. And there, I managed the fossil fuels program pertaining to oil and gas and technologies. And we produced a lot of good products for the country and adding more production to the U.S., and particularly looking at the ultra-deep waters in offshore technologies. Recently, I've been working in the refining technologies pretty successfully at looking at heavy crudes and how we can actually produce more gasoline, diesel, and jet fuels out of the heavier and heavier crude that are being produced globally. And again, being appointed, as you pointed out, to the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice is a pretty big job, and we look at a variety of different research areas, not only the upstream, but also the midstream and transportation technologies, as well as the downstream in refining there at Rice. Rice has a very fine history of doing research as a research institute here in Houston in this area. But we also have a very fine, very good history of commercialization as well, not only for our technologies that we research in the university, but also other technologies that come in to our Rice Alliance program. So there are several institutes that are in existence there at Rice, covering everything from IT to energy, and also the Baker Institute is one of the premier public policy institutes in the country. So quite a bit going on, and certainly in the alternative energy areas, there's quite a bit happening as well.
1999, as you looked at energy futures in America, was where we are now sort of on the table? How was this being viewed? Were people in positions of power and decision makers at that point conscious of the fact that we could get to this point so soon?
Very much so, Sid. I had been looking at, you know, production trends and so forth through Energy Information Administration, the EIA, which is our agency that looks at projections and numbers, production numbers. And the IEA, the International Energy Agency out of Europe, and they have their own projections. And I had been looking at the different trends, and certainly President Clinton and Secretary Richardson were very much aware of how important domestic production is here in the United States to, you know, not be so dependent. I think we're always going to have some dependence on foreign crude and fossil fuels some way, somehow, whether it's LNG or crude oil, so forth, that are now being imported. But we can certainly blunt the foreign control and wrest more control with our destiny using our own production. Onshore production has been on the decline for the last couple of decades, and even at flat out drilling for oil and gas here onshore, you're basically just stemming the decline curve to a flat line. You're not increasing production that's needed, you know, using onshore production. And The big hits are really coming out of Alaska, which is very political. Again, it's going to take a long time to get online because of just the transportation issues down from that part of the world through Canada or through Alaska. And so really the big hits are going to be in the ultra-deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico. And those are very, very strategic production areas. And again, what it depends on primarily are the technologies on how to extract, how to produce those that oil and gas from the Gulf of Mexico. And the challenges for production are immense. There are probably greater challenges of production from the deep Gulf. Now, those are incremental fields, you know, that once we put them on, those do stem our decline curves and add to our production domestically. But the challenges, again, are greater than those that we faced going to the moon. So because of the different atmospheric changes that we go through and through the water columns and so forth. So I think that was one of our main and key focuses when I was at DOE, and we did see how important, how relevant this was domestically for us. And also for the Clinton as well as the current Bush administration, alternative energy has been something that we know that helps on the marginal areas of, again, our energy production, whether it's biofuels or solar or wind, that those technologies, and even nuclear, have to play a role in our energy independence. And it's all about control. And I was asked a couple of weeks ago about $100 barrel oil and what that means or what that'll mean to the United States. Being an American, we're very innovative people, very creative, and we're going to work our way through this. It's just how we do it. And I believe we're going to become very efficient at how we use energy, and we're also going to become very educated about energy. Our energy IQ is pretty low in this country, and a lot of people just don't understand where gasoline comes from after you pump it out of the service station and how that supply works. And also people just don't understand when you flip a light switch, you know, where your power is coming from either. So I think that pretty rapidly we're going to, you know, up our energy IQ, and we're going to, you know, up our efficiency as well. And that's probably the biggest thing that we can do to help ourselves is become more efficient. And then after that, everything comes into view. And again, what we looked at the previous administration was, you know, what impacts the production of heavier crudes we're going to have into our system. And that's what really frightens me, is that the next shoe to drop after these high prices is going to be supply of refined product. That's very important. It's supply of refined product.
Help us understand that a little bit more.
It's very simple. In that today, there's a production of crude that's about 85 million barrels of crude production globally, you know, give or take 100,000 barrels every day. The refining capacity is about 85 million barrels of refining capacity a day. So we're at a very sharp edge, again, give or take, depending on which refinery is down for maintenance or whatever globally. You know, we're at this very fine line of balance between production and refining. At the same time, most refineries are only capable of refining these lighter-end crudes, the sweeter crudes, and all the time those are dwindling, and we're producing more and more heavier crudes, the higher API numbered crudes, and they have a harder time refining those because of the processes that we have today. So I just know that eventually, since no refineries, that's a huge investiture of money, is creating new refineries, especially here in the United States domestically, with a lot of different challenges, a lot of different ways, and putting a new refinery online. Our demand is increasing globally. China and India are the two countries that everybody refers to now, because those economies are coming into their own, and the demand is going to be there. So it's not like the 70s when we had an oil crisis where it eventually all tapered off because production finally caught up with our demand. Globally now there's some new players on the scene, and so the demand's always going to stay high from now on. Now, again, the production of this refined product, I think, is going to be the next area that we're really going to have to be cautious about. And, again, I see technologies as being the answer. There's different ways to hydrogenate crude oil to make it more refinable, and I guess that's my word for it, where we get more of the refined products that we need using these new technology methods rather than the ones that are currently being used by the refiners.
Well, this is an area that I don't hear much discussion about, and I appreciate your perspective on this. If I think about it, it makes perfect sense. You know, every once in a while, a refinery, a major refinery, will go down, and the price of oil universally in the United States goes up. So this relationship of refinery production and prices, we're intimately tied to that. And so in terms of modifying and adapting our refineries to these heavier crudes, which are going to be coming online ever more frequently and in a greater percentage, is that being addressed?
I think that slowly but surely, I think the refiners are starting to realize that, even the blending of the heavier and lighter crudes, when they come together, you still have all the heavy metals and sulfur in suspension, and the refineries are only capable of handling those so far, and then the refinery goes down for maintenance at a particular point. So I think they are starting to realize that, and globally, again, the real sharp visionaries, I guess, in our industry today are saying we do have to modify these things to adapt to these heavier crudes.
So at this point, we're taking the sweet crude, we're taking the cream off the top, and we're running into these crises. Do you have a concept how that might alter the amount of available oil that may be available into the future here? Does it change the equation?
Sure does. Our government predicts that there's actually more pockets of these heavier crudes globally, but then are they producible, and then are they, you know, once you extract them, putting those types of numbers to it, are they able to be refined? And so it goes back down to the fact that can we use our technologies to our best effort here, and at $100 a barrel, it makes it very economical to look at hydrogen to make this heavy crude more refinable. You know, the mixing process with hydrogen and heavy crudes, I guess chemically, you elongate the molecule of carbon. Rather than it looking like a buckyball, it becomes longer, and then you emulsify it, and you get more of the refined product that you need, mm-hmm. like jet fuel, diesel, gasoline, and you add more of that rather than toluene, benzene, nonene, and petroleum coke, which has very low value because the BTU content is extremely low on petroleum coke. So it just makes it more efficient to utilize it that way.
We're getting it probably deeper than most people are interested in following, but it's important. And these are the things that people, as you say, our energy IQ is fairly
limited,
right? And these are the questions and issues that we really need to become educated about. And I appreciate your knowledge about this. We'll kind of move forward here. So therefore, as we look into the future, how are we proceeding towards, because people are talking about energy independence. Some people are saying by 2020, some by other things. It has many, many definitions in terms of what that actually means. What does it mean to you? And if you were to take some steps right now, what do you think are some of the most important first steps right now that America needs to be addressing?
Well, again, efficiency is the key word. You know, we have to become more adept at using our energy wisely. Being from Texas, you know, we've got to look at SUVs and, you know, big pickups a little bit differently than we have in the past.
Oh, darn, huh?
Yeah, well, that's just the way it goes. I think that's primarily one of the areas that we have to look at. But then also investing in our technology is something that we have to have more emphasis on.
Give us an example of how you would recommend increasing efficiencies. Which sectors are you talking about?
Well, certainly the transportation sector is one of them, but when it comes down to the environmental efforts, making more efficient buildings, building more efficient buildings becomes critical as well. I saw a study 2 weeks ago that said that our buildings were so inefficient that if we really looked at the technologies that were available today, we could lower greenhouse gas emissions from our buildings by 60% if we were adjusting, you know, the way we efficiently built our structures.
Briefly talk about some of the technologies that you're referring to in terms of changes in buildings.
The building technologies are windows, heating, air conditioning systems that we put into them, at Rice, we were looking at different ways to cure concrete and so forth. I mean, there's just a lot of different ways that we can become more efficient in the way that we build our structures. So,
how about the sort of midterm? What should we see in 5 years? Where should we be? Where would you like to be?
This is something that I've worked closely with the Rice Alliance on, is putting together a platform to create a new marketplace for our greenhouse gas technologies and other environmental emissions technologies, if you will. Those are actually profit centers. They're not cost centers if you really utilize them properly in capturing greenhouse gas emissions. So over the next 5 years, I would think that just for arresting not only carbon but other methane emissions, that we can utilize these technologies and actually make money capturing methane, for example, that has twice the BTU value of natural gas and selling it back into the pipeline. But today, globally, it's sad to say that because of the rush to produce more oil and gas, there are more oil and gas flares today than ever before. That's just flaring right into the atmosphere, which I think is almost a sin at this point.
In terms of long term, how do you see this moving out into the future? How could we advance sustainability?
Technologically, by looking at the different solar technologies that are there, the different wind technologies. Of course, I'm smack dab in the middle of the wind capital of the United States, which is Texas. Our land commissioner here has been very aggressive in changing policy to allow these, you know, wind farms to exist, for example, and the same goes for solar. The federal government, my former agency, the Department of Energy, has been very good about establishing the different centers to study how to more effectively utilize our technologies and our materials to test wind blades and the solar panels and so forth. And we've got a new center here in the Gulf Coast to actually do that. But they're around the country. It's just not in Texas. So we've got quite an effort going on in this area. So that's in my opinion, the future. Nuclear certainly is another technology that we're revisiting as far as how we efficiently build those in a standard way other than a one-off way, which we have in the past, which was very inefficient.
Utilizing more the French model?
Sure. I mean, I think that I've been to France numerous times and see how well they've done with their nuclear capabilities. And that's because they standardized. And
right.
It just makes sense. I mean, for safety reasons, for maintenance reasons, it all seems to come down to, if you do them out of a cookie cutter, then all your parts seem to fit and the engineers know what to look for.
Getting online with nuclear, that's one of the biggest issues because it takes about 10 years to put one online.
Absolutely.
And so, therefore, obviously, if things are more standardized, that process, I'm sure, could be shortened dramatically.
All of these things that have got to be in the mix. Mm-hmm. I think they become more and more relevant. But you've got to start today. Even these refining changes that I talked about, you're talking about a two-year window to get some of these things online if you started building today. And the demand yet continues to grow more and more. So,
Well, let's move right down into where you are right now, which is at Rice University and the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute, which is part of the Alliance for Technology and Entrepreneurship. You are really addressing this in a most unique and powerful way. Give us an overview of how the Alliance is moving forward.
In terms of the sustainable technologies that we were talking about before, we've got research going on in biofuels, wind power. We're looking at wind turbine technologies, turbine blades. We're looking at offshore and onshore wind turbines themselves. We're doing the analysis and design to look at blade vibration suppression, so the blades stay in sync.
Yeah, they do have to work together, don't they?
They do. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, you can imagine what the conditions are like with these things facing the elements all the time. We do risk analysis on the fragility and vulnerability of the blades. And also we've got one of the first, if not the first, carbon nanotube production laboratories in the country. Dr. Richard Smalley was the one that started the institute there at Rice, and it's still going strong today. And so we're very much into nanomaterials for the turbine blade development and power conversion. So we're also looking into nanotubes for power transmission. We're doing solar research utilizing some of these nanotechnologies as well to better absorb the energy from the sun. Matter of fact, we just got an award, or maybe it was the made it into the Guinness Book of World Records of creating the darkest material ever created, you know, using nanotechnology.
By the way, I'm just curious because everyone's throwing the term around nanotechnology, but when you talk about nanotubes for transmitting energy, that's one I'm not familiar with.
Just from my layman's understanding of the nanotube technology is that you have less line loss than the current metal technologies that we use.
Is it a metal based, but you're just transforming it into a more efficient form?
Correct, and it holds the energy longer, as I understand, and so it makes it more efficient.
There you
and
go. So, okay, that makes sense.
We're also very focused on something that's not very sexy like the nanotechnologies because these have different applications, but we're looking at real good maintenance technologies in the corrosion area. We've created the Corrosion Center there at Rice University with the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, which is NACE. They're located here in Houston, and our focus for the center is on new corrosion technologies. And again, nano plays a role in that, even though it's not sexy to talk about maintaining a bridge structure or maintaining a pipeline, but corrosion takes its toll after 50 years because some of these infrastructure pieces are very, very old and are starting to fall apart on us. But the hope is, Sid, that, you know, with using something like a nano super hydrophobic technology, that not only can we arrest corrosion, but actually stop it. So we're looking at detection technologies on, you know, for stress corrosion and cracking, but we're also looking at how to prevent them as well, which is, I think, is critical. If we can extend their life expectancy, you know, using these new technologies for coatings as well as cathodic protection, fighting corrosion, then hallelujah, you know, we've made another breakthrough.
What that translates directly to in the long term is fewer mountains that have to be ripped up and shredded to get to those raw materials.
Correct. I mean, and it's all a question of how can we extend the life of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten to the point where there's some folks that would probably say, well, it's okay. We can, you know, we're wealthy enough or we're strong enough to replace some of those things periodically. Well, sure we are. And it's just going to cost us a lot more unless, you know, if we can prevent things from wearing out or from rusting, you know, through corrosion, then we ought to be utilizing these technologies. And now I think we're to the point after our pipeline failures and some of these bridge failures that we've seen recently, there's really a focus by our Congress and by our government, especially the state governments now are starting to come back around and saying, what can we do to not only detect but prevent these failures from happening? And that's what our focus is about with this Corrosion Technology Center at Rice.
Well, what I find fascinating about the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice and the Alliance for Technology is the fact that you're integrating so many aspects of the university and what it brings to bear in terms of research, a business, and environment. And what you're really focused on is now bringing this to market. That, to me, is the very important critical element.
The Rice Alliance, for example, on bringing it to market, they have several programs every year to bring biotechnologies, information technologies, as well as energy and nano to market. They bring in the investor as well as the technology group together, the inventor. We match those up there at the Alliance. We're going to go past those four that I just mentioned and look at greenhouse gas and greenhouse capture. This is education and research coming together, and it's actually the integration of science and business. That's the best way to describe it,
mm-hmm,
and what
yep.
we do. And we've got, over the past 5 years, we've got multiple success stories, you know, in commercialization, bringing about innovations from the laboratories, the inventors, again, mm-hmm. to the marketplace, you know, with the investors. I think it's a very good program that we've started, and we continue to have, you know, really good success with it.
Some people see this as a cost. In reality, it's profitable.
Oh, very much so. So from the sustainability side, I think that's where we're really making a big difference. Again, from the oil and gas side, you know, we do research getting in more into the oil and gas realm today, energy world, past corrosion. You know, we do research into seismology. We do research in enhanced oil recovery, flow assurance, which is you know, really critical for offshore production, so you can actually bring what you're producing to shore. We look at natural gas hydrate production and seafloor stability, which is something that I helped with when I was at the Department of Energy back in 2000. We do well logging technologies and also look at different tar sands and oil shale extraction, carbon management. We actually do work with robotics to look at autonomous robots for flexible tubing inspections on the seafloor.
See, what's interesting is that I think a lot of people don't understand that all of this is really part of sustainability. We're looking at all of the large-scale things, the solar and wind generators, but in reality, bringing these to market and all of the micro technologies and adaptive technologies that are required is a huge part of this.
Yes, and actually here, I'd like to invite your listeners to come in if they could find a room here in Houston in the first week of May for the Offshore Technology Conference that we have. It's the largest conference that we have in Houston. We have over 60,000 people, engineers, and so forth attend.
Wow.
The conference at our Reliant Stadium. These are massive to produce oil and gas, you know, under the Gulf of Mexico, under the oceans. But globally, these companies come from all over the world, Norway, from France, from Brazil, and they have not only the state oil-owned oil companies and technology companies, but the private side comes together, and it's just a incredible show on how to more efficiently and effectively produce oil and gas. I tell you, those technologies become not only efficient, but also become very environmentally friendly if used properly, and the footprints that we leave behind now from the conventional side become smaller and smaller, and through horizontal drilling and some of the other incredible technologies that we have, we do it in harmony with the environment. And again, it just takes a focus to get us to produce better, and we're going to be dependent for a long time. It's going to be a long bridge into the future, into the sustainable, totally sustainable technologies, and we're going to be fossil-based. And I truly believe that all of these things have a relevance, and I'm never ignorant about ignoring any of the new technologies like solar or wind. Certainly we don't at Rice, but we also are very strongly supporting and helping research in the conventional areas as well, conventional oil and gas, which to me, without that, there wouldn't be the other at this particular point.
I really get your point, and I appreciate that, because I know that you are someone who is very dedicated to all of the environmental values that so many of us share, and that you're applying your greatest wisdom to do this, to deal with really the real issues that a lot of us just don't have any idea about. Emil Pena, I want to thank you, and I want to, why don't you give people information about how they can find out more about what's happening with you and the Energy and Environmental Systems Institute at Rice University?
You can go to our website, which, you know, it's www.rice.edu, and from there it launches you into our Systems Institute, and check us out from there. I've only been at Rice since October, but we're giving our website a new look and linking it more efficiently to the other areas there at Rice that help us with our institute, such as the Baker Institute, and other areas, too, that on this Baker Corrosion Center and all, we'll have our website up for that pretty rapidly. But for the policymakers that are listening today, can't happen without good public policy. And so we not only are working in the science and engineering areas, which are the base for all this, but without the policy, it doesn't happen nearly fast enough.
That's part of the new technology as well.
Exactly.
Emil Pena, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sid. Have a great day.
The American miracle. Share the dream. Now, more than ever. Wishing you all a warm place to be, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.